Well, it appears today our larger attendance is online, so that's fine. Hope I don't scare anybody away. I do have a tough subject today, one that I hope will be informative to everyone. It's going to consider some things that we understand from a slightly different point of view than we normally address. But this was an outgrowth of our Bible study a couple of weeks ago, where we were going through the first few chapters of the Gospel of John. And we came to that segment on the Samaritans, particularly the where Jesus met the woman at the well, that famous section of Scriptures. And that triggered a number of interesting thoughts. A lot of times we read through the Scriptures and it goes through rather fast, or we, you know, we pass right over things and we don't stop to think about them. But I want us to stop today and take a closer look at the words of those Scriptures, and then I want to bring in some other factors that I hope will be able to put the whole picture in a much better light than perhaps we have understood. There was a television program years ago. I haven't seen it lately. But it was called Connections. And there was this fellow with a deep British accent. And he would take what we would think is ordinary things. And in the entire program, he would walk through from one topic to another, showing how that one thing helps develop the next thing. And I found that show fascinating. It's the kind of thing that appeals to me. Well, I have three major segments here in this message that I hope to be able to weave together as he did in his general approach to things, that I think will open our eyes a great deal on the subject of the Passover. Now, I might mention, and a lot of times I forget to mention, but I might mention that I just rushed to get this booklet completed, and there's extra copies over there if anybody would like one. And I think when you hear some of this information, you might want to you might want to have some of it in writing. But it's got just a few chapters, three of which I didn't realize until I was looking at it just this morning. Three of these have already been presented as messages before this congregation in the past. The last chapter especially, that you might remember, it was about the third or fourth time I ever spoke here, which would have been like 2003, somewhere back in there. Passover and the Bride of Christ. It shows where Christ first proposed marriage to the New Testament church. And you might find that chapter very interesting. The Abrahamic Covenant, I think I spoke here once, that's the one that covers the maledictory oath and all of that, showing how that the Passover was first introduced to Abraham in a very, say, not obvious way, along with the promise of the Exodus. It goes way back into Genesis chapter 15. Chapter 2 here describes the Passover of the Exodus, which focuses more on the size of the Exodus. How big was Israel? When we realize the size of that congregation of people, it factors into how long it took for various things to take place. And that also factors into the Passover tradition. There are two definite ways, and perhaps even a third way, to estimate the size of the congregation of Israel. And both of them, within 5% of each other, come out to a figure of about 3 million. When you include all of the Israelites, the mixed multitude that went with them, and all of their livestock that came with them. That was no small undertaking. Now, knowing that, we can know how long the Exodus took from leaving the city where they were until they were across the Red Sea. Chapter 3 talks about the overlooked plague, which shows the 3 days of darkness. And when you place those 3 days of darkness where they belong in the narrative, you can see why they had to select their paschal lambs on the 10th, not any day later, and keep it up until the 14th. The ninth plague also factors into the sequence of events that led up to the Passover. So it's all interesting stuff. There's several other things here. I won't get into it, except for chapter 8, which is the last blood sacrifice. And the last blood sacrifice is a chapter out of a National Geographic magazine, if you can believe that. Why would the National Geographic be writing about the true Passover? If you know the mentality or the agenda of the National Geographic people today with their anti-religious or certainly anti-Christian and evolutionary slant on everything, this is rather strange. Until you realize that this particular National Geographic article is January 1920. Now, I was browsing around in an old used bookstore, rather famous location in my own hometown of Springfield, Massachusetts. Johnson's bookstore had an annex out back, upstairs, where they had this huge room full of old and used books. And I was browsing in there, as I often did. And in fact, I got a lot of good reference material out of there. But I came across this National Geographic. And being new in the church, it was only about in the middle 70s when I picked it up. It looked interesting. It was talking about the Passover. Well, I was, you know, just learning about the Passover. So I thought, well, this can't be, this might be of interest. So I bought the issue, spent my 35 cents, and picked up this old National Geographic. And I still have the issue if you want, if anyone wants to see it. But I was reading through it, and at the time, it didn't seem relevant to my interests. It wasn't really talking about the Passover as we understand the Passover. It was talking more about the tradition that was kept by this group of people who happened to be Samaritans. Now, realizing that, I said, well, you know, the Samaritans weren't Jews anyway, which is true, they weren't. So how would that be relevant to anything? So I put the issue away. I didn't want to waste my 35 cents. So I kept it. But then after moving out here in the early 90s, someone gave me an audio tape of Jim Rector. I don't know if you're familiar with that fellow, but he spoke on the Passover, and it was about a three-hour sermon. But he advocates what is known as the late Passover tradition. Now, we have people in our general fellowship who are of that persuasion. And it is consistent with the Jewish position on Passover, those of what we would call the Pharisaic persuasion. The Jews had two traditions. People aren't fully aware of that. It isn't emphasized all that much, but there is the Sadducean tradition, which held that the Passover should be killed immediately after sunset, beginning the 14th day, where the Pharisaic persuasion defers doing the killing of the lambs until the mid-afternoon of the 14th. And that is the more popular position in Jewry. And it has affected some of our people, even in the church today. There are those who hold to the late Passover tradition. There's a major organization which believes that anciently the Passover in Egypt was late, but that Christ changed it to be early as we practice it. That is something that I hope we can look at today and sort of iron out. The Church of God today observes Passover at the beginning of the 14th day, whereas the Jewish custom is the following evening. They define evening as from noon till sunset, whereas we define evening as that interval of time between sunset and full darkness. There's the difference. There's the primary source of the difference. But when we put all these things together, it comes out with a very interesting picture. And it's that picture that I would like to present to you. I want to begin in John chapter 4, which is especially revealing on a number of fronts. John chapter 4, and this is sort of the area that we covered in our Bible study, and it brought out something that I didn't realize. The question in our minds is, who are the Samaritans? Now, the Jews and the Samaritans basically despised each other. And we see some of that in the narrative in the New Testament. Not that the church did, not that Christ did, but the Jews despised the Samaritans and vice versa. There was a schism between the two that kept them from involving themselves too much in each other's theology. They maintained separate traditions, and when we understand what those different traditions were, it becomes really, really revealing. But in John chapter 4, it presents this picture for us. Verse 1, when therefore the Lord knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, though Jesus himself baptized not, but his disciples, he left Judea and departed again into Galilee. Now what was happening is, the climate was getting a little bit hot for Jesus. The Pharisees were looking to do him harm. And he thought it prudent to get out of there. Now, this is very early on. This is early in Christ's ministry, if we could call it that. There was this baptizing incident or this baptizing phase that was going on. Jesus and his disciples were participating, but somehow it was creating a problem, and Jesus felt it prudent to go up to Galilee, which was way north. He left Judea and departed again into Galilee, verse 3. And he must needs go through Samaria. In other words, Samaria is south of Galilee. You could go around and get up there another way, but he chose to go up through Samaria. Then cometh he to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now, Jacob's well was there. So that tells us this area has a very old history. Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat there on the well, and it was about the sixth hour, mid-afternoon. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus said unto her, give me to drink. Verse 9, then said the woman of Samaria unto him, how is it that you, being a Jew, asks drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Jesus answered and said unto her, if you knew the gift of God, and who it is that says to you, give me to drink, you would have asked of him, and he would have given you living water. The woman said unto him, sir, you have nothing to draw with, and the well is deep. From whence then hast thou that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? Notice that she refers to her ancestry, which gave us the well and drank thereof himself and his children and his cattle. Jesus answered and said unto her, whosoever drinketh of this water shall thirst again, but whosoever drinketh of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst. But the water that I give, that I shall give him, shall be in him a well of water springing up unto everlasting life. When you think about it, that's a very profound message to deliver. Verse 15, the woman said unto him, sir, give me this water that I thirst not, neither come hither to draw. Jesus said unto her, go call your husband and come hither. The woman answered and said, I have no husband. Jesus said unto her, you have well said, I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and he whom you now hast is not your husband. In that sayest thou truly. The woman said unto him, Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. How did he know that about her? Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Now there's another consideration. Theirs was the worship center. That mountain, the mountain of Gerizim, that was the worship center for the Samaritan peoples, whereas Jerusalem was the worship center for the Jews. Jesus said unto her, verse 21, Woman, believe me, the hour comes when you shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship you know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. This is a pretty profound sermon. We don't have a sermon like this preserved where he spoke to Jews, at least not this early on. This is amazing stuff. And who is he speaking to? A woman of the town, really. She knew a lot of men. She married five and was living with a sixth. And who knows how many other friends she had. Consider who this woman is. Not just a Samaritan. She was famous, in a way, in her own area. That's who Christ was using to get to these people. It's pretty profound when you think about it. Now, here's a famous quote. And we often think of it, but do we think of it in the context in which it was given? I'll go back to verse 23. But the hour cometh that now is when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father seeks such to worship him. That too is a profound diversion from the typical belief system of the time. Their religious practices were tied to a location. And he's telling her location is irrelevant. God is a spirit, verse 24, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. He said that to a Samaritan. The woman said unto him, I know that Messiah cometh, which tells us something else about her and her people. I know that Messiah cometh, which is called Christ. When he is come, he will tell us all things. If you haven't underlined verse 26, I would suggest you do. Jesus said unto her, I that speak unto you am he. He revealed himself as the Messiah directly to a Samaritan woman. He wouldn't say that to a Jew. He'd be stoned if he tried that in Judea. He told his disciples in another place when they admitted to who he was. He said, see that you tell no man. Because to make that claim in Judea could have been lethal. But he says to her plainly, I am the Messiah. And she believed him. Down to verse 28, the woman then left her water pot and went her way into the city and says to the men, come and see a man which told me all things that I ever did. Is not this the Christ? And he probably said a lot more than was written here, but anyway. Then they went out of the city and came unto him. In the meantime, while his disciples prayed him, saying, Master, eat. But he said unto them, I have meat to eat that you know not of. Something was going on that they didn't necessarily understand just then. Therefore said the disciples unto one another, has any man brought him anything to eat? Jesus said, my meat is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. He's saying, that this exchange with the Samaritan peoples, which was his first evangelical mission, if we could compare it to that, was to these people, the Samaritans. If he despised them, if he held them in contempt, why would he have done that? There's a reason why he did. Because the Samaritans did not have the hard set traditions and beliefs that their Jewish brethren did. Here's another verse. Remember, this was said in the context of a message to Samaritans. Say not ye, there are yet 4 months, and then cometh the harvest? Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white already to harvest. How many times have we used that verse without realizing who it was referring to? The peoples north of Judea, the peoples of the northern kingdom of Israel. Verse 36, and he that reapeth receives wages and gathers fruit unto the life eternal, that both he that soweth and he that reapeth may rejoice together. Down to verse 39, and many of the Samaritans of that city believed on him for the saying of the woman which testified, he told me all that I ever did. Now, for that to have any significance, he must not have known her previously. Because if you knew somebody and told them everything they ever did, well, what's the big deal? Because they know you. For this to be remarkable, it must have been that he didn't know her. But he read, he knew of her history, he knew of who she really was without having ever met her before. That impressed these Samaritans. But it wasn't the only thing. Verse 40, so when the Samaritans were come unto him, they besought him that he would tarry with them, and he abode there 2 days. And many more believed because of his own word, and said unto the woman, now we believe, this is the men speaking, now we believe not because of your saying, for we have heard him ourselves, and know that this indeed is the Christ, the Savior of the world. A very profound passage of Scripture, but even more so when we realize its context. Christ first open ministry, if we can call it that, was to Samaria. And as we read in verses 3 to 5, particularly a town called Sychar. Some people say Sychar and I forget the name of the town. But anyway, they're thinking they're one and the same. And that'll be important in a minute. But the first named believers, as we can read in chapter 4, verse 41, were Samaritans. The first to admit that they believed in him. The first to be written of. They recognized that he was the Messiah. Chapter 4, verse 42. This event took place near Jacob's well. Verse 12. This mountain was a competing worship center. Verse 20. He didn't commit to the Jews like he did to these Samaritans because of the Jews' hearts. We can read of that in John 2:23. They had wrong traditions, and they had wrong ideas of the Godhead. The Jews sought to kill him. We can read of that in John 5, verses 16 and 18. They sought to kill him for Sabbath breaking and alluding to his being the Son of God. That didn't play well in Judea. He first preached in Galilee only after John the Baptist was killed. So we know that this incident with the Samaritans was long before that, because John was still baptizing when he left for Galilee through Samaria. Luke 4:44 and Mark 1:14 tell us that. He refers in the passage that we read to 4 months to the harvest. That would be late May. Late May would be Pentecost season. Those who are familiar with the Gospel of John realizes that John brought in many holy day references. And this is one of them. This message to the Samaritans went out about Pentecost season. Christ used a woman of well-known reputation. Could we say ill repute, in a way, to co-evangelize the people of Samaria. He admitted his true identity to this woman. When he said, the fields are white unto harvest, when he said, worship in spirit and in truth, those were to the Samaritan people. It adds a little significance to those statements when we realize where and to whom they were said. In Mark 10:6, he says, I am sent, I am not sent but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now that brings up a subject that came up in our Bible study. Were these Samaritans Gentiles? Some were. Samaria was the region north of Judea that was populated by many foreigners. We'll see how that happened as we get through this. But not all were. There were ethnic Israelites, not Jews, ethnic Israelites, still living in this region. If Christ had gone to Samaritans, who were Gentiles, then when the early church 20 years later began taking the gospel to the Gentiles, wouldn't this have been listed as a precedent? But it was not. So that tells us that the people to whom he was speaking were not Gentiles. They were Samaritans who were of Israelite descent. Now the Jews were the southern kingdom. Judea, the kingdom that remained loyal to the crown, whereas the northern 10 tribes broke off and became a separate nation. Christ also spoke of Samaritans in another context, comparing them to the Jews. He attributed them with different qualities, perhaps because of their religious beliefs, I would think. But he refers to them as exhibiting kindness, the story of the Good Samaritan. He was kind to one of the Jews' own people, where the Jews turned up their nose and walked by and left the man. That was a Samaritan who did that. Christ spoke of them showing that quality. He also shows them having the quality of thankfulness. There was an incident where he healed several men, and only one came back to thank him. And wouldn't you know, it was a Samaritan who was thankful. Somehow the others felt they were entitled to being healed. I guess, I don't know. They didn't come back. They didn't say thank you. So Christ didn't have a negative regard for Samaritan peoples as his brethren, the Jews, did. The religious climate was quite different in Samaria, and that's what we can see from this passage of Scripture. When he claimed to be the Messiah, they didn't grab up stones to throw at him, as the Jews might have. In Acts chapter 1, verse 8, and chapter 8, verse 1, and in 8, verses 4 to 8, we see that the Samaritans were generally receptive to Christ's message. But the important thing about them is that the Samaritans preserved what we call the Sadducean tradition. And that's what we're going to see from this other segment that I want to present to you. Like I say, I found that National Geographic article in the mid-70s, and I read it at the time, and I didn't see any relevance in it, so I just filed it away. And I didn't have occasion to look at it again until we moved out here, and it was probably the 92-93 era, where I was given this tape by Jim Rector. And Jim is very persuasive. And I was generally persuaded at the time, hearing his message about the late Passover tradition, how the Jews killed the lambs in the afternoon of the 14th day. And he goes into so far as to say that even Abraham and Isaac and Jacob always killed the Passover in the late afternoon of the 14th day. Except that Passover wasn't known or given until 10 generations later in the time of Moses, but that be aside. But I saw his message as so significant that I did a transcript of it all 3 hours, and it took a long time. And it's tightly spaced, the type, and it's probably 10 or 12 pages, I'm not sure. But it's rather long and rather convincing. But he was so thorough in his presentation and rapid fire and somewhat convincing that I thought it was worth looking at this again. Well, that's when this article took on a relevance that I hadn't seen before. But the Passover tradition, there are two traditions, and that isn't well known, that isn't well advertised, and that isn't always discussed. We come at this issue as though there was only one tradition, and we have to understand how that happened. When Rome fell to the Romans, the Sadducean priesthood, the Sadducees were basically the elite of the religious community. They weren't particularly powerful. They weren't particularly dynamic at the time, if that's the word. They basically held control of the temple and its services. But it was the Pharisees who were the militant ones, if that's the word, or certainly the most dynamic. And it was the Pharisees who gained the they gained popularity with the general public. The Pharisean tradition is what prevailed after Jerusalem fell. It became fully incorporated into the Jewish traditions of the modern era. And people act today as though that was the only tradition there was. Well, no, there were two traditions. And Christ and his disciples would illustrate that fact, that there were two traditions. Christ and his disciples did not observe the Passover with the Jews. Now, you might say that, well, they had to observe it at a different time because Christ was on the cross when the Jews would have been slaying their paschal sacrifices. But that wasn't the reason. There was no need to explain to the early New Testament church why they were keeping it differently, because they didn't have a question. They understood that. But the Sadducean tradition advocates the early Passover observance, whereas the Jewish Pharisean tradition advocates the later tradition. And that's where this National Geographic article comes into play. And it's contained in the booklet. The whole thing is reproduced here. There's some 26 pages that have been photocopied and put into this booklet. And you can read it for yourself. But let me go through and point out some of the things that this article says. On page number one of that article, the Samaritans are remnants of a once numerous sect whose persistent continuation and literal performance of the Passover sacrifice have attracted the attention of students for three centuries. On page 23, the Samaritan religion is closely akin to that of the Jews, The chief difference is being that the cult of the former centers around Gerizim, that's the mountain in the north, while that of the Jews centers around Zion. The Samaritan canon of Scripture is restricted to the Pentateuch, or the five books of Moses. The latter writings, including the prophets and the Psalms, the Samaritans repudiate as uninspired. So the Samaritan scriptures were basically the first five books of Moses. Now, if we understand the later writings, some of them, especially after the captivity in Babylon of the southern kingdom, the later writings reflect some of these modified beliefs that came into the practice in Judaism. That's one of the reasons why they repudiate the later parts of what we call the Old Testament. Their scriptures are only the first five books of Moses. In view of the similarity in their beliefs and practices, it seems strange that there exists and has always existed the fiercest animosity between Jew and Samaritan. But it is the animosity that invariably exists between an original and a schism. Think about that. Think about what this article just said. The animosity that invariably exists between an original and a schism. Have we seen any of that in our splits? Isn't there an instant animosity between one another? It's natural. So when it happened with them, humanly, the same thing happened. And animosity developed. Now we can evaluate the merits of that or the demerits of it if we want. But the point is, it served a purpose. This animosity kept Jew and Samaritan separate from one another. The Samaritans did not incorporate Jewish revisions to their worship practices. There's more here. Let me read some more. The Samaritans maintain that they are the remnants and descendants of the once great tribe of Ephraim. And Ephraim was the leading tribe in the northern kingdom. They are the remnants and descendants of the once great tribe of Ephraim, and that the split between them and the Jews came along through the maladministration of the priesthood by Eli's sons. Eli's sons were doing their thing about the time Samuel was being groomed to become the priest. That's how far back this split goes. The split began over religious issues. Eli's sons were a pair of reprobates. And Samuel had to come along later and clean up the mess. But that's when this split supposedly happened between that segment of people who later became the Samaritans. Now keep in mind, in this National Geographic article, we're referring to Samaritans who were living about a century ago. They kept to themselves. For the most part, they did not intermarry. They were a fading sect, getting smaller and smaller because of that restriction they put upon themselves of not intermingling with others. But these Samaritans claimed to be the descendants of the tribe of Ephraim. They were not Jews. They were Israelites, and they began their traditions and they preserved their traditions from the time of Samuel, basically. The Samaritans assert that their Pentateuch scroll was written by Abishua, the great-grandson of Aaron, although it is believed to be the most ancient copy of the Pentateuch in existence. While the Jews, and here's another, consider this one carefully. While the Jews have scattered all over the world since the captivities, and have absorbed much that is foreign, in many instances, adapting their religious practices to their new environment. The Samaritans, on the other hand, have, during the same lapse of time, lived in the land of their forefathers among Semitic peoples akin to the Hebrews, and because of this fact have handed down to the 20th century a glimpse of the old Israelite church almost in its purity. A notable instance of the survival of an ancient religious ceremony is the celebration of the Passover sacrifice. Now, the similarities that the Samaritans saw in themselves with the Jews was with the Sadducean tradition, not the Pharisean tradition. Continuing, this is all from the National Geographic article. One of the distinct differences between the Samaritans and the Jew lies in their methods of computing the calendar. Oh, they had a calendar issue, huh? Where have we ever heard of that? The Samaritans base their calculations on the moon, but they are at the same time also governed by the movement of the sun. So the Samaritan calendar was slightly different in that it recognized a different method of determining the first month, and that occasionally made them 1 month different than the Jews, though most of the time they were together. The point is, they're using the same calendar, but with a different 13th month added in different years than the Jews. That's still going on, I might add. For the above reasons, and that's referring to this calendar issue, for the above reasons, the Samaritans celebrate their Passover with or nearly with the Jews, while at other times their 14th of Abib comes a month behind. Just a month behind, not days behind, it's just a month behind. In other words, they intercalated the 13th month in a different year than did the Jews. Neither one was using the Abib, I might add. The Jewish method did not, and apparently the Samaritan method used solar determinations rather than the first ripe barley. Now, as it gets into the performance of the service, we read these facts. It's about 3 hours before dark, and since the Samaritan time count starts from sunset, so the Samaritans counted days from sunset to sunset. 3 hours before dark is mid-afternoon. That's when they began to gather, but that's not when they killed their lambs. Now keep in mind, they're claiming to be identical with the Jewish custom, with only minor exceptions. The aged high priest, it continues, with his eyes upon the setting sun, he reads the first 12 verses of the 12th chapter of Exodus, wherein are given the first commands regarding the observance of the Passover. As the reading proceeds, it is so arranged that as the passage, then shall all of the congregation of the assembly of Israel slay it between the two evenings, is spoken. At the word slay, each of the slaughterers cuts one throat and jumps to the next. The time that they killed their lambs was at the time of the setting sun. The article continues, thus the passage between the evenings, the Samaritans translate to mean between sunset and dark, the twilight hour. Now, if you don't find this astounding to find in the National Geographic magazine, if it were a modern one, but this was long before that ilk got control of the magazine, I suppose. But it's very accurate. It's not only accurate with what they were observing, but with the Jewish encyclopedia, which I'll get to next. But let me finish with this. If we have any question about when they did their sacrificing, it continues. It is now only about 4 hours before midnight. when the spits are simultaneously lowered into the oven. They roasted their lambs in a slit oven in the ground, and they, of course, put fire and hot rocks in the bottom, and then covered it over, and it made like an earthen chamber, and that's how they cooked their sacrifices. It is now only about 4 hours before midnight when the spits are simultaneously lowered into the oven. If we have any doubt about when they did this, 4 hours before midnight, about 8 p.m. And the author mentions that the present paper is written after having witnessed the Passover ceremony four times, twice before the Great World Conflict, World War I, and twice during it. So the man saw enough to correctly interpret what he was seeing. And the final passage I want to pull out of this National Geographic article is this. Thus, the 3 to 4 hours between putting the lambs to roast and the feast roll quickly by. So they killed the lambs immediately after the sun had set, beginning the 14th day. It took about an hour to clean them and prepare them. They took the wool off and all of that, and the offal. Prepared them, bled them. That takes some time. Probably using up all of daylight. And then they put them in the ovens, roasted them from 3 to 4 hours, and ate of the Passover just before midnight. Now, when did the Israelites in Egypt do the same? What midnight was it? If you go by the Pharisaic persuasion, that midnight, and they killed the lambs in the afternoon of the 14th, and the 15th began at sunset, and it took 4 or 5 hours, those lambs wouldn't be ready to be eaten until well into the 15th. Which midnight was it that the Lord passed over in Egypt? Was it the 14th or was it the 15th? Well, we have scriptures that show that they were out of there on the 15th. After a day of getting ready, a day of spoiling the Egyptians, a day of getting massed up ready to go, and it takes a long time to mass up 3 million people. And besides that, keep in mind, Moses told them to stay in their houses until daybreak. They weren't to go out during the night. Whereas under the Pharisaic tradition, they had to leave immediately after midnight. There's enough points there where I think we ought to generate some useful questions. But the Samaritan tradition, which claims to have been perpetuated unerringly, consistently, from the time of Samuel to the 1920s, would say that the lambs were slain just as the sun had set, beginning the 14th day. Now, that is the tradition that the majority in the churches of God observe. But it's a question I think we need to settle in our minds. Let me read from the Jewish Encyclopedia on the subject, and I'm amazed how much the content of this particular article compares with that geographic article. And this claims to be the unedited full text of the 1906 Jewish Encyclopedia. It says, properly, in other words, answering the question, who are these people? Properly, the inhabitants of Samaria. The name is now restricted to a small tribe of people living in Nablus, which is the old town. The old name for it is Shechem. That's the name I couldn't think of. Shechem, and calling themselves Bene Yisrael. Their history as a distinct community begins with the taking of Samaria by the Assyrians in 722 BC. Now that is true speaking of the political division, but the religious division occurred, like I said, back in the time of Samuel. The kingdom was split away in 928 BC and was taken captive by the Assyrians in 722. In other words, the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah coexisted side by side for about 200 years. But there was a distinct separation, first religious, then political, and then after Judah fell to the Babylonians, the political motivation was irrelevant, and it became purely religious. Continuing with the Jewish Encyclopedia. On the separation of Israel and Judah, the ancient city of Shechem, which had been from the first so intimately connected with the history of Israel, became naturally the religious center of the northern kingdom. And that's where this Jacob's Well and so on and the Mount Gerizim is. Mount Gerizim became the religious center of the northern kingdom. That's where all of this took place. The political capital, however, was transferred by Omri to his newly built city of Samaria about 883 BC, quite a long time later. And the Israelitish kingdom continued to exist there until it fell before Assyria in the fourth year of Hezekiah. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it, and at the end of 3 years, they took it. The inhabitants were deported. This is important. The inhabitants were deported to various parts of Assyria and to the cities of the Medes, and colonists were sent to take their place. Why did they do that? The colonists were soon after troubled by lions. We're going to read a scripture that talks about that, which they regarded as a divine visitation due to their ignorance of the manner of the gods of the land. It shows that there was a religious consciousness from the locals that these colonists were living among. At their request, an Israelitish priest, and I might say an Israelitish priest of their own tradition, not of the Jewish tradition, they didn't ask for a Jewish priest. Keep in mind, the Jewish establishment was still in place for some time, about 150 years after Israel fell. Israel was taken captive by the Assyrians. Judah was taken captive by the Babylonians about 150 years later. They didn't ask for a Jewish priest. They were sent one of their own, who settled at Bethel. We can read of that in 2 Kings chapter 17, with the result that a mixed form of religion was established, partly Israelitish and partly idolatrous. And that might be true of the nation at large, but not necessarily of all peoples there. The city actually fell in the reign of his successor. This is talking about the death of the fellow who began the siege. His successor Sargon in 722 BC, who, according to his own account, carried away 27,290 of the people. They had a very accurate count. When you think about that number, it doesn't make sense. Only 27,000. Israel, when it came out of Egypt, had 600,000 men of military age. This is a tiny fraction of that population. So the idea that Samaria was populated by Gentiles is not true. The majority were not deported from their own land. It would be the influential people who were, those who were likely to cause trouble, the political people, the people of influence, the people of wealth, the ones who would likely create a revolt against their conquerors. Those were the ones deported out of there. But the common people were not. It is not to be supposed, however, that the country was in any sense depopulated by this means. This is the Jewish Encyclopedia saying this. Though the persons removed were undoubtedly the more prominent and dangerous of the inhabitants, the rich, the priests, and the ruling class. The population, therefore, which then occupied the site of the defunct kingdom of Israel, and which was thenceforth properly called Samaritan, consisted of a substratum, probably a strong one, of Israelites, chiefly of the poorer sort, with an unknown proportion of aliens under an Assyrian governor. Now, getting into the matter of religion, again, this is the Jewish Encyclopedia of 1906. From the 5th century B.C. onward, the relations between the Jews and the Samaritans were, as shown above, undoubtedly hostile. The opposition was, however, essentially political, the old rivalry between Israel and Judah persisting. Personal relations must have been mutually tolerant, as it appears from the Gospels, where in spite of their contemptuous attitude, the disciples buy food in Samaria, in a Samaritan city, John 4:8. Later on, when misfortune befell Jerusalem, when the temple was destroyed and the temporal hopes of Judah were shattered, political opposition ceased to have any reason for existence. In the Mishnah, it is evident that the differences have already become purely religious. The grounds for them are clear. If Manasseh, about 430, had brought with him from Jerusalem not only the Torah, but the system of belief and practice recognized there, that system must have been what is sometimes called Sadducean. This is telling us that the Samaritan religion was generally aligned with the Sadducean persuasion, not the Pharisaean persuasion. The belief and practice recognized there, that system must have been what is sometimes called Sadducean, or more correctly, the old Israelitish creed as it was before the reform of Ezra. At this point, the religious development of the Samaritans was arrested. The Samaritans stopped changing their practices. We can't say that of the Jews. But the religious development of the Samaritans was arrested. They adhered rigidly to the Torah, never admitted any of the prophetical teachings, never codified their canon law into a Mishnah, and never developed their halakha to meet the necessities of altered conditions. Realize what this is admitting. It's admitting that the Jews altered their scriptures to their new conditions. The Jewish religion evolved over time. The Samaritans claim that theirs did not. With that in mind, we have to ask ourselves the question, what was the original time for observing the Passover? It's a more important question than we might realize. What would happen if there was this same controversy back in Egypt? If some were keeping it on one evening and some were keeping it on the next. Somebody would have been left out. Somebody would have been hurting. They had to have been together at some point in time. But there are many things that show the time necessary for all of the things to take place for the Exodus to have happened. We know the Exodus happened. And we know that gathering up 3 million people who had been told the night before, we ain't going anywhere, stay in your houses till morning, and whatever's left of your paschal lamb, burn it before, you know, by daybreak. How do you get 3 million people out of there on the road before the next morning? Obviously, it had to be a day later. Now, keep in mind, burning the remains of the paschal service before morning, that's not something you do indoors. Do you ever burn a steak by mistake? Do you ever leave the turkey in the oven too long or too hot? Or, you know, stinks. They wouldn't all be burning the remains of their paschal lambs with the skeleton and all the tissues and all that. They wouldn't be burning that indoors before morning. Obviously, that was done outdoors. And the scripture says they did it according to what they were told. They stayed in their houses until morning, and they burned the remains in the morning like they were told. They couldn't have all been gone out of there before daybreak that same year. There's enough evidence, even in the Pentateuch itself, that should tell us when the Passover in Egypt was observed. Now, as to the inhabitants of the land, let's look at 2 Kings chapter 17. I want to add that. There's a little time left here. Because the presumption is that these Samaritans were all Gentiles or half-breed Gentiles or who knows what. Not true of all. And there's evidence right here in 2 Kings 17, beginning in verse 23. And you can read the verses that lead up to this. I think we're familiar with the story. This is describing the captivity that took place, like we said, in about 722 in the 8th century B.C. Until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, 1723, as he had said by all his servants, the prophets, so was Israel carried away out of their own land to Assyria unto this day. The Assyrians never came back. I'm sorry, the Israelites taken into Assyria never came back. Whereas the Judahites, captive by Babylon, did come back 70 years later. But these people never did. And the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Kuthath and from Abba and from Hamath and from Shepharvarim, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel, and they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. This is where the king of Assyria brought in people taken captive in other lands to displace the intelligentsia or the influential people of the kingdom of Israel, based in Samaria. And so it was at the beginning of their dwelling there that they feared not the Lord. Obviously, these were pagan peoples. Therefore, the Lord sent lions among them, which slew some of them. And so it was at the beginning of their dwelling there that they feared not the Lord. Therefore, the Lord, I'm sorry, I just read that. Wherefore, in verse 26, they spoke to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations which you have removed and placed in the cities of Samaria know not the manner of the God of the land. Therefore, he has sent lions among them, and behold, they kill people, because they know not the manner of the God of the land. There was still a religious consciousness there, which tells us the general population was still there. And they took the matter of their religion somewhat seriously, not saying they were completely accurate. It's just they took their religion seriously. Verse 27, then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, carry there one of the priests whom you brought from there. In other words, one of their own priests was brought back to them. And let them go and dwell there. And let them teach them the manner of the God of the land. Then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. So even though some of the population was taken, still the majority of the peoples living in the northern kingdom of Israel were still of Israelite descent. So the Samaritans were not necessarily pagan peoples. Now, by the 20th century, that's a different story. And that's why this small sect of Samaritans is regarded as a dying sect. I believe there's some of them still living, but it's a very small community. But Christ went to that location. And I don't know if the writer of this National Geographic article realized it or not. But he was right in the very same location where this incident took place with the woman at the well. Same place. The well is still there to this day. I believe it's gone dry. But they know where it is. They know this location. And he was right there where Christ had been in 27 A.D., I think that's profound. But what this whole story tells us is that our tradition, the Church of God's tradition, which we take from the New Testament, there's no doubt when Christ observed the Passover. Paul makes it very clear in the very night in which he was betrayed. That was obviously the night before the Jews kept their Passover. The Jews of Pharisaic persuasion. But the Church of God keeps the same tradition as far as the timing of the observance of Passover, as did the early church, the church prior to the captivities, prior to the development of the Pharisaic persuasion. The same time in which the Israelites in Egypt kept it, and coincidentally, the same time that these 20th century Samaritans kept it, killing their lambs just as the sun set, beginning the 14th day of the first month of the lunar calendar. Hopefully I've included all of the information here that we need, but I thought this might be helpful to those who are not necessarily polarized on the matter. I hope it will give us the evidence that we need to be confident when we discuss these matters, that our time of observance is consistent with the Bible instruction. And I hope this has been helpful.